Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Greg Pallast, investigative reporter with BBC Television's Newsnight program, who takes a critical look at the judgments rendered by Lord Hutton in his investigation into the suicide of British weapons scientist Dr. David Kelly. Author and activist Gwendolyn Mink, who assesses the Democratic Party presidential candidate's attention to the critical issues of women and poverty. And Zach Exley, organizing director with the MoveOn.org Voter Fund, who discusses the controversy surrounding his group's effort to broadcast a 30-second ad critical of the Bush administration during this year's Super Bowl game. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In the wake of an investigation into Pakistan's assistance to nuclear programs in Libya and Iran, Mohammed El-Baradei, head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, has admitted to the German-based Der Spiegel magazine, a nuclear black market has emerged, driven by fantastic cleverness. Designs are drawn in one country, centrifuges are produced in another, they are then shipped via a third country. IAEA inspectors are working with Pakistan's officials to break the black market, the scale of which has shocked Western intelligence officials. The IAEA has concluded that Libya used the black market to buy equipment for turning uranium into weapons-grade material. The Guardian newspaper reports that Libya had acquired designs for a nuclear warhead. Much of the nuclear equipment and technology found in Libya was based on Pakistani designs that itself was a copy of European concepts over 30 years old. Speaking to the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, Pakistan's President General Pervez Musharraf blamed rogue scientists for giving away nuclear secrets for personal profit. The government has denied any knowledge in leaking its nuclear technology to other Muslim countries. In a dramatic development on the issue, the founder of Pakistan's nuclear program, Abdul Qadir Khan, signed a confession detailing 15 years of activity in selling nuclear technology to Iran, North Korea, and Libya. The Progressive magazine reports that major oil companies are looking to drill in the 1,200-mile Great Barrier Reef off the coast of Australia. Shell Oil, TSG Nopec, the Norwegian oil exploration firm, and scientists aboard the Texas A&M ocean drilling ship are trolling the scenic waters near the Barrier Reef to map the potential of the oil reserve, estimated to be worth $150 billion. The area, which attracts over 4,000 fish species and many varieties of marine mammals, holds 5 billion barrels of crude oil, the equivalent of Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. For decades, Shell has set its sights on the Great Barrier Reef, which in 1975 was incorporated into a marine park to protect its coral and marine species. Australian Senator Andrew Bartlett, a critic, charges that the government of Prime Minister John Howard was cooperating with oil interests in a systematic deception, while they move inexorably towards an offshore oil industry that will directly threaten the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park. Eco-activists worry about the decade-long activities of the Texas A&M drilling ship, which has sampled 5,500 meters of ocean sediment, verifying the existence of oil reserves. The ship made a visit in 2001 on a project relating to climate change, but its deck was sprinkled with oil industry observers. Urged by the Bush administration, the United States Supreme Court will hear a case later this year that could cripple the Alien Claims Tort Act, or ACTA. The law allows international victims of human rights abuses to seek justice in U.S. courts. The case, Alvarez-McChain v. U.S., involved alleged abuses by a Mexican policeman who, acting on behalf of the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, kidnapped and brought to the U.S. a Mexican citizen charged with killing a DEA agent. On December 1, 2003, the Supreme Court accepted an appeal sought by Attorney General John Ashcroft without any comment. Over the last 2 years, the Justice and State Departments have stated in court papers that the ACTA interferes with U.S. foreign policy and the Bush administration's war on terrorism. The ACTA was first used 25 years ago by victims of torture to seek redress in American courts. More recently, human rights lawyers have used the law as a basis of lawsuits against major corporations such as Texaco, Unocal, Dow Chemical, Chevron, and ExxonMobil for tolerating abuses in developing nations. Starting in 2002, the National Foreign Trade Council, along with ExxonMobil and Unocal, lobbied the Republican-controlled Congress with complaints about the tort law. Soon, the Bush administration joined in and tried to get federal courts to throw out human rights lawsuits. In his filing to the Supreme Court, U.S. Solicitor General Ted Olson claimed ACTA prevented the Bush administration from using all available methods, including kidnapping, to prosecute the war on terrorism. The Supreme Court had rejected all previous ACTA appeals, but Earth Rights International believes that corporations targeted under the law have exerted their political influence to convince the High Court to review the case. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Soon after David Kaye, the chief U.S. weapons inspector in Iraq, resigned from his post, he declared before a Senate committee that Iraq likely possessed no weapons of mass destruction. Kaye's statement fueled calls for the establishment of an independent commission to look into the failures of U.S. spy agencies and investigate whether or not the Bush administration had manipulated intelligence to justify its war. President Bush, who initially resisted pressure to set up a commission, switched sides and announced that he would establish a bipartisan panel to conduct an inquiry. But critics say that members of a commission appointed by the president won't have the independence to closely examine the serious charges leveled at the White House. Meanwhile, in Britain, Prime Minister Tony Blair's government was cleared of wrongdoing in an investigation conducted by Judge Lord Hutton into the circumstances surrounding the suicide of weapons scientist David Kelly. But Hutton's criticism of the BBC's report that the government had sexed up intelligence used to justify joining the American invasion of Iraq led to the resignation of the BBC's chairman, director general, and Andrew Gilligan, the reporter involved. According to several opinion polls, about half the British public believed the Hutton report was a whitewash, with a majority saying that the BBC was unfairly blamed in the investigation. Tony Blair has followed Washington's lead in establishing his own inquiry into intelligence failures in Iraq. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with investigative reporter Greg Pallast of BBC's Newsnight program, who takes a critical look at the judgments rendered by Lord Hutton in the Iraq affair and the repercussions for journalism both in Britain and the U.S.
They've circled the wagons. They don't call it a ruling class in Britain for nothing. You have to know who Lord Hutton is. He's the guy that was judge and jury in the secretive Star Chamber trials of accused terrorists in Northern Ireland. Now, there really were some terrorists in Northern Ireland, but we don't know if we got them because those accused were not allowed to question the witnesses against them to find out who testified against them, and the whole operation was secretive and no jury. Hutton got to be judge and jury. Basically, you have a situation in which the good Lord has saved Tony Blair. You should understand, Dr. David Kelly, the subject of this investigation, he was a weapons advisor, not just to Tony Blair, but to George Bush as well, as the chief biological weapons inspector for the United Nations. He was advising, again, both Blair and Bush. So this is not a British issue here we're talking about. We're talking about whether our president lied, not just the prime minister of Britain. What happened was we had a prime minister who said that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. These words were repeated by our president, who in fact cited British intelligence. We now know, because the CIA thought this was, as the British would say, a load of bollocks. And so our CIA wouldn't go along. So our president kept talking about British intelligence says. Well, did British intelligence in fact say that Saddam Hussein was, and I'm going to, this is the headline in a British paper, Brits 45 minutes from doom, that in 45 minutes, Saddam could launch an attack and, you know, it would be the new London Blitz. And another headline was Saddam could have nuclear bomb in a year. And this is how the war was sold in Britain and, of course, how the war was sold in the U.S. But the British took it pretty seriously. They believed it. And then when they found out it wasn't true, they were a little bit upset. But the way they found that it wasn't true is that in America, when George Bush made these claims and said Saddam has the bomb or almost something like it or nuclear dirt from Niger or whatever, the American press just nodded its head and dutifully reported the president said today. In Britain, BBC our network had the view that if we're about to go to war on the basis of a claim, maybe we ought to check it out. And for checking out the truth and going to the sources, the people who wrote the reports, basically Lord Hutton shot the messenger. You could play games with whether Gilligan, who was reporting at 6 in the morning and literally talking back and forth with a radio news anchor, could have chosen some better words. Like he, for example, in effect accused Tony Blair, the prime minister, of knowing the intelligence information was false. But that requires, you know, the reporter to have gotten into the tiny mind of Tony Blair, which is, you know, I don't know whether you want to go into that. Don't forget, they took out against this poor Andrew Gilligan and hung him over, you know, his use of words. The fact that my program was cleared was not reported. And that's very important because we came to the same conclusion that the information provided by the government was not true, or that they weren't giving us the full information that they had, which is that there were questions raised by the people who actually wrote this report and provided the core information. So, you know, is every single report by a BBC reporter, including myself, you know, beyond question? No. What I have to fear now is that we don't want to become. In fact, a memo was leaked that suggests that there's going to be extra scrutiny on my program in particular that I work with. I welcome extra scrutiny. I'm always happy to have other people scrutinize. What I have to worry about is BBC, the absolutely the most open, aggressive, investigatively based news network on the planet. Are we now going to become, you know, as a government agency, are we now going to become the new British Izvestia?
There's probably a great deal of fear running in the organization that, as you just said, this investigation and the pronouncement by Lord Hutton will chill good, aggressive investigative reporting on the part of reporters there. What about the rest of the British press and public? How do they see this investigation and its conclusion?
I think it's a chill throughout British journalism, not just at the Beeb. One thing that is good, though, that the public itself, according to the polls, is quite skeptical of the Hutton Report. Not that they think that the BBC is so wonderful, but that it's a much more trustworthy agency than the government. And for all the attacks on the BBC, there still ain't no weapons of mass destruction in the sands of Mesopotamia. American soldiers are dying every day, and British soldiers are dying in proportion. Unlike the American public, which seems to now be going along with the idea that, well, we went in for the weapons of mass destruction, but hey, they weren't there, but, you know, it's been a good party anyway, and a good time was had by all. The British public isn't buying that, and so Blair is still in trouble. Now, it's true, if the Hutton Report went the other way, he wouldn't be prime minister today. He'd be out this week. But, you know, he's skipped the bullet, but it ain't over.
That was investigative reporter Greg Palast of BBC's Newsnight program and author of the New York Times bestseller, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. Visit his website at www.gregpalast.com. In a recent national survey conducted by the Lifetime Women's Television Channel, 85% of women said a candidate's position on violence against women would impact their vote in the upcoming presidential election. 82% cited equal pay and women's health issues as a priority, and 76% chose access to affordable child care. Unfortunately, the candidates are barely addressing any of these issues. The websites of almost all the candidates pay homage to these and other gender-specific issues, but on the campaign trail, they're all but silent about them. At a forum last summer sponsored by the National Organization for Women, the only candidates who attended were Howard Dean, Dennis Kucinich, Al Sharpton, and Carol Moseley Braun, who is no longer in the race. Dean, Kucinich, and Joe Lieberman were the only candidates to participate in a women's forum held in New Hampshire just before that state's primary. Frontrunner John Kerry and his rivals John Edwards and General Wesley Clark were all missing in action. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Gwendolyn Mink, author, activist, and member of the Welfare Made a Difference campaign. Mink is particularly concerned with the impact of current economic policies on poor women who are recipients of welfare funds under the Temporary Aid to Needy Families, or TANF, program. She charges that in Kerry's appeal to military veterans, he has totally ignored pressing gender issues. She goes on to comment more favorably on the positions of Dean and Kucinich.
It's a very serious problem, which is about to become worse as the Republican reauthorization legislation looms on the horizon. And it's important for the people who are presenting themselves to the electorate as leaders, potential leaders of this country, to be able to address that issue in a way that shows whether or not they have an appreciation for the rights that are at stake and whether or not they care about ensuring the equality of all women.
I know you also said you could comment about Howard Dean as his candidacy relates to women's issues.
I want to comment on what he did in New Hampshire last weekend, which was to convene a women's forum and then to appear at the Lifetime TV women's forum that was held at Dartmouth College later. In those contexts, and especially in his own women's forum, he did discuss a range of issues affecting women, among which was included welfare reform, which he discussed in ways that I don't necessarily agree with, but in ways that demonstrated a comprehension of the double burden uniquely facing a single parent with caregiving and wage-earning responsibilities. And so in that context, he talked about supporting TANF, of Vermont being a leader in the direction of welfare reform in the context of, for example, providing educational opportunities for recipients and counting engagement in educational activities as fulfilling the work requirement through such innovations as providing transportation so that recipients could get to work, for example, and through increasing the coverage for child care so that, as he put it, no child would be left unsupervised under the conditions of this work-oriented welfare reform. And he talked about other kinds of questions as well, the minimum wage, the need for living wages for women, Title IX. I mean, the whole sort of range of issues that deeply affect the capacity for women to act independently and with security in the world. And so for that, he does deserve credit, although, as I've intimated, I certainly don't agree with him on some aspects of his position on welfare reform.
What in Dean's position do you disagree with?
From his point of view, the idea of a work-oriented welfare system is a good thing. Consistent with the sort of early Clinton Democratic point of view, pre-1995-96, the work-oriented welfare reform would, on the one hand, require mothers to enter into labor market work activities, but on the other hand would also provide social support, such as child care, job training, and the like, to make it feasible that participation in the labor market would yield wages and circumstances that, you know, were good for families. The problem with work-oriented welfare reform, since we have no control over the labor market in a capitalist society fundamentally, we're creating a situation in which lots of people are not going to be in a position to make ends meet and simultaneously are not going to be able to avail themselves of welfare. So that's a dangerous way to go. But from the political perspective, the big problem with work-oriented welfare reform is that it doesn't begin by recognizing that what a parent does in raising her kids is work. And so from my point of view, and from the point of view of many recipients and grassroots groups and advocates and the like, it's extremely important for a leader with a progressive vision to start from the standpoint that caregiving work in families by family members is work that is worthy of social support.
Are there any other candidates that you feel have a good position on women and on especially issues related to poor women?
Kucinich is a leader on welfare justice that supports women in their caregiving responsibilities and sort of advocates a transformation of the current welfare regime into one that respects the rights and the dignity and the choices that women make instead of taking those rights and dignity and choices away just because they are poor.
That was author and activist Gwendolyn Mink. For more information on issues of women and poverty, call the Welfare Made a Difference campaign at area code 212-894-8082 or visit their website at www.wmadcampaign.org. We'll be right back. When millions of viewers around the world tuned into this year's Super Bowl game, they saw an exciting football game, a little more than expected of Janet Jackson during the halftime show, and a flurry of costly advertisements for beer, razor blades, and junk food. But what Super Bowl viewers did not see was a 30-second political ad titled Child's Pay that calls attention to the Bush administration's $1 trillion deficit. The ad, which depicts young children working in adult jobs, beat out 1,600 other entries in a contest titled Bush in 30 Seconds, run by MoveOn.org, an internet-based progressive activist group. Although MoveOn raised $1.6 million to pay for the ad during the Super Bowl, CBS refused to sell them the time, claiming that the Child's Pay spot violated the network's policy prohibiting the broadcast of advocacy advertisements. Although the ad wasn't seen during the Super Bowl game, the controversy has given MoveOn a blizzard of free publicity focusing on issues of censorship and the responsibility of broadcasters to allow all sides to have their say on important issues affecting our society. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Zach Exley, organizing director with the MoveOn.org Voter Fund, who discusses the ad controversy and the goals of his 1.7 million member organization in this year's presidential election campaign.
For better or for worse, American politics, and you know, I think for worse, American politics are driven by these 30-second ads. 90% of the political expression that happens in elections have become terrible. I don't know whether it's the, you know, the culture of consultants who produce them or the candidates who order them up, but these ads have just become negative and boring and simplistic and very uncreative. And when we were thinking about how this year we're going to be raising a lot of money to run a lot of these ads ourselves, we wanted to branch out and give our own membership a chance to give regular people and amateurs out there a chance to produce some ads. And so that's where we came up with the idea. We did get 1,600 ads. The membership voted on and rated the ads themselves, and we narrowed it down to a group of about 20 or 30 finalists. The winner for the main category was really a great ad, and we went out and asked our membership if they would donate $1.6 million to run it on the Super Bowl, run a 30-second ad on the Super Bowl. That's how much it costs to run a 30-second ad on the Super Bowl. The amazing thing is that they wouldn't run our ad because they said it would be offensive. Whether they knew or not about what Janet Jackson was going to do, they knew that they were going to run, you know, a number of ads that, you know, were basically using mostly naked women to sell beer. And I mean, you guys have probably covered this on previous issues of your show. CBS is in the middle of lobbying the White House for some changes to FCC rules that will save them millions and millions of dollars. So it's all very suspect, and it was just a sad day, I think, for media fairness when they turned down this ad.
So what was your reaction initially? You used the power of the Internet to flood CBS with a lot of letters of complaint. What happened next?
We've got 1.7 million people who receive our emails and participate in our campaigns, and we did tell them about this. And after all, thousands and thousands of people had donated money to pay for these ads, to put them on the Super Bowl. So, CBS got a lot of calls, got a lot of emails, and they got the message. And we also directed calls and emails to the FCC. But in the end, because of the controversy, the ad got played so many times that we probably got more viewers of this ad with CBS not running it than if they had run it.
There was one other bit of confirmation that MoveOn.org has arrived as a very powerful and dangerous organization for the Republican Party when they attacked two of the 1,600 ad entries for comparing Bush to Hitler.
Out of 1,600 ads, two ads, they weren't well-done ads at all. They were just something that, you know, two different people slapped together. And the only time I've ever seen the ads was on TV, because the RNC distributed them to all the networks to play in their news shows. And yeah, it was a concerted hit. Hardly anybody saw those ads on our site because all the bad ads just dropped out of rotation during voting, and those ads were gone after just a few hours. Probably less than 100 people saw both of those ads. So just think about what that means. It means that the Republican Party had an army of researchers watching all of the ads. They recorded probably all of them. They pulled those two out, put them on TV, and Ed Gillespie, the chairman of the RNC, every single day for 7 days, for a whole week, he plugged the story on the news, every talk show he could get on. And, yeah, I mean, I think they were trying to discredit Move On, but at the same time, you know, they're just pushing their line. They're very aggressive about attacking the Democrats and attacking anybody who disagrees with them as being radical leftists, you know, being crazy people who would compare Bush to Hitler. But in this case, I think it actually backfired on him. You know, I don't think they were taken seriously, and I think the message got out, you know, that this was actually an ad contest with thousands of submissions by regular people, that it was actually an expression of democracy, and I don't think that attack served them well.
Just for 30 seconds, let's hear one of the runners-up to the ads that won high praise from your membership. This one's called, "What Are We Teaching Our Children?"
If elected, I'll lie about weapons of mass destruction as a pretext to invade another country.
I'll call myself an environmentalist, then gut clean air standards.
Our allies will go from respecting us to hating us, and I don't care.
I'll leave no child behind, unless they can't afford it.
I promise to keep you in a state of fear and anxiety, so you never question what we're doing.
And if you do, we'll call you unpatriotic.
Zach, what's the goal of MoveOn.org in this presidential campaign season? What are you going to hope to do?
Well, the Move On Voter Fund is trying to put out, just trying to get the facts on the Bush record out to the voters, and especially to the voters in those states that matter so much in this election. You know, the Bush administration, more than probably any administration in my lifetime, is willing to just completely lie, just tell very blatant and simple lies about their own record. So laws that allow polluters to pollute more are called the Clear Skies Initiative, for example. And we need to refute those lies. We need to get the actual facts about what the Bush administration is doing out to the voters. That's our goal, and we're going to do whatever it takes to achieve that goal.
That was Zach Exley, organizing director with the MoveOn.org Voter Fund. View the winners of MoveOn's Bush in 30 Seconds ad contest by visiting the group's website at www.moveon.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer-Cousineau.